When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants were changed towards the people. And they said, "What is this we've done, that we've let Israel go from serving us?" So he made ready his chariot, and he took his army with him, and he took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them, encamped at the sea by Pihahiroth in front of Baal-zephon. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Is this because there are no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us, bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." And Jesus said to the people, "Fear not. Stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you will never see again, and the Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent." The Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry land. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, so that they shall go in after them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gained glory over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen." Then the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was the cloud and the darkness, and it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry land, and the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses and his chariots and his horsemen. And in the morning watch, the Lord, in the pillar of light and of cloud, looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and upon their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. And as the Egyptians fled into it, the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen. Of all the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea, not one of them remained. But the people of Israel walked on dry land through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord had used against the Egyptians, so the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses.
Thanks, Joan. Really glad those guys are sitting down. I didn't trust them not to be pulling faces behind my back. Do keep your finger in that reading that we've just had. Tonight we are going to be flicking around a lot, so I want to make an apology for that at the beginning. But we are, as Tim mentioned, we're doing an overview of the whole Bible. And having been kind of plodding along in first, second gear the first 3 weeks, we're now crunching straight into fourth gear and going into overdrive. So we've got quite a bit of ground to cover. And I hope I can keep you with me. Well, let me just ask you a question as I start. Have you ever been really excited about a plan that you've made? I don't know, something maybe like a home improvement plan. You know, something you've been saving up for. That perfect new bathroom. That home cinema in the loft. Or maybe a holiday that you're planning. You know, that trip around the world that you've always wanted to do. Or the 2 weeks in the sun and the sea that you've got booked later this year. A brilliant plan. Well, we've been learning over the first 3 weeks of doing our overview of the Bible about God's plan for his world, this world. We've been tracing the Bible's main plot line, if you like. And as we've been doing that, we've seen how God has always had a plan for a kingdom. And it really is a brilliant and exciting plan. So, for example, when God first made the world, we saw that he set up his kingdom. And it had three main parts. It was made up of his people, God's people. People who were in a perfect friendship with each other and with God, living in his place, God's place. A beautiful and a perfect garden, full of all the good stuff that God could possibly ever give them. And they were enjoying God's rule and blessing. God was the perfect king in his perfect kingdom. As people happily submitted to his loving rule, they enjoyed the best that life could be, the most deliriously happy life. Now, who wouldn't want to be part of a plan like that? But we saw how it all went wrong. Just like you and I reject God's rule, we saw the original people did that as well and tried to run the show themselves. And the result was this perfect kingdom was mucked up. People were kicked out of God's place and out of friendship with God and under the well-deserved sentence of death. But all of this didn't mean that God had given up on his brilliant plan, because it was such a brilliant plan. But we saw last week that his plan to have a kingdom was still very much on track. In fact, he promised a guy called Abraham that his family would be made into God's people and would be given a great place to live by God and would enjoy a unique friendship with God. And through that family, God promised that he would draw people from all around the world to be part of his people. I guess what we're looking at this week is how God made good on those promises partially. Okay? So looking at how God kind of fulfilled those promises partially, not fully. Well, it might sound a little bit strange. Why did God only partly fulfill them in this part of the Bible that we're looking at? And basically the reason that he did this was to give us and to give people, to give the world a great big signpost pointing to the day when he would fulfill it to the full in Jesus. Because all of this stuff about God's kingdom is basically fulfilled in what Jesus has come and done. Jesus is building a kingdom and God invites all of us to be a part of that kingdom. Okay, so that's where we're going. And we're going to look at people, we're going to look at place, and we're going to look at rule and blessing in turn. So I hope you've got your seatbelts on, because we'll have to go at quite a pace. Firstly, God's people. And we're thinking about what Genesis 18, that's the first book in the Bible, Genesis, to Exodus 18 is all about. And basically God had promised, as I've said, he promised this great kingdom in the future. He said to Abraham, I will be their God. So he said he would have a people and he would be in a special friendship with them. And basically throughout the rest of that first book of the Bible, we get the amazing story of how God made that promise start to come true for Abraham. So for example, God miraculously gives Abraham and his wife a son, an heir. Even though they're pensioners and Sarah is barren. And then God preserves the family line through a series of troubles and hardships, even a famine. So that by the time we get to book number 2 in the Bible, which is the one we're in now, we'll just turn back a few pages and you'll see what God had done to Abraham's family. It's page 54. And it says Exodus at the top of the page. And I'll just read verse 7. But the people of Israel, that's the nation that was descended from Abraham, were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. In other words, God has started to make his promise that he would grow from Abraham a people. He started to make that come true. The only trouble is
They're not where they should be. They're living in Egypt. They're foreigners in a strange land, and the king doesn't really like them. So look at verse 13. Just cast your eyes down the page. So they ruthlessly, that's the Egyptians, made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. And you know, in all those hard years of slavery, the Israelites must have wondered if God had completely forgotten about his plan for a kingdom. But you know what? He hadn't. Just look over the other page. Chapter 2, verse 24. And God heard their groaning. And God remembered his covenant, that means his promise, his agreement with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. And from then on, God starts to make his plan to rescue them out of slavery, to belong to him. He starts to make that happen. And in enters a guy called Moses that you may well have heard of. And he's the guy that God has chosen to be the rescuer. So if you just turn over the page, you'll see the heading in my Bible says, Moses is given powerful signs. God meets Moses in the desert and says to him, I want you to go to Pharaoh and tell him to set my people free. Moses is a bit reluctant, as you might understand. He was just a shepherd. Who was he to go and speak to the Pharaoh? But God sent him, and eventually he went. But just cast your eyes to chapter 5, verse 2. Look at what Pharaoh says. And Moses goes to him and says, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. But Pharaoh said, who is the Lord? Who is God? Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord. And moreover, I will not let Israel go. Basically, why should I listen to God? What claim does he have on me? And God actually sets out from that point on to answer that question for Pharaoh. It shows him why he should listen to him. God sends plague after plague upon the Egyptians as judgment for Pharaoh's disobedience. So if you just flick over the page, you'll see the different headings. I'll tell you about the different plagues. The first plague, water turned to blood. The second plague, frogs, and so on and so on and so on. And each time, what happens is that Pharaoh's heart just gets harder. And so the plagues get worse. He refuses to let the people go. It's only actually when we get to chapter 12, page 65, 64. The final plague that breaks Pharaoh's resistance. God basically sends the judgment of death upon all the firstborn sons of Egypt, all the people that would be leaders, all the people that would be heirs in the family. The only trouble is, when God comes to sweep through the land to bring this judgment of death, he knows the Israelites, well, they're not really that much better than the Egyptians. They're rebels against him too. They deserve death. But God graciously gives them a way out. So that's what that chapter 12, where it says the Passover is the heading at the top. That's what that's about. Basically, God gives them a lamb to kill as a substitute. They deserve death, but the lamb dies for them instead. But with that, the rescue isn't over, because we saw in our passage, isn't we? We finally reached it now. Over in chapter 14, page 67. That Pharaoh does let them go, but he changes his mind. So our reading, verse 5, when the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed towards the people, and they said, what is this we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us? So he made ready his chariot and took his army with him, and he basically goes after them. And as they sit there by the Red Sea, the Israelites, they've just come out of slavery, they sit there by the Red Sea, they are scared, powerless, trapped. Literally between the Pharaoh and the deep blue sea. What happens in the reading we've just looked at is that God works an amazing miracle to rescue them. And he saves them again. So just turn over the page. Then Moses stretched out his hand, and read in verse 21. Stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. The people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And then verse 26, the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and upon their horsemen. And Moses does, and that's what happens. God saves the Israelites, but he pours water down in judgment on the Egyptians and drowns them. God has shown Pharaoh that he is God. And there's a remarkable thing, because in the second half of the Bible, the half that was written after Jesus came, it talks about this event. And it says that it's kind of a bit like baptism. Now, that's a bit strange. What could that mean? We see, just as God rescued the Israelites from the judgment that he poured on the Egyptians, God has done the same for his people now through Jesus. He's given us a substitute, Jesus, to die in our place, just like the Israelites had. And more than that, he's defeated our enemy that has us enslaved. You see, the Bible says we're all enslaved, not to the Egyptians, but to our own sin. Our own tendency to drift away from God and ignore him. Well, Jesus has defeated that enemy by his death and by his rising again. Which, if you remember, that was what we said baptism was all a symbol of. Jesus' death and resurrection which saves his people. And Conrad and Sandra and the godparents have confirmed their trust in that rescue today. And they promised to bring Joseph up to know about and to trust that rescue too. And that's great. It's really such a privilege to be here and share that with them. But the promise of being rescued by Jesus' death and resurrection to be part of God's family, his people, isn't something that's just for them. It's for all of us, whoever we are and whatever we've done. You see, just as the Israelites were safe and dry from the water, we can be safe and dry from God's judgment when it comes. Because Jesus was drenched in it for us. And the judgment on the Egyptians was terrible. And so will the judgment be on us unless we trust the promises of God too. The promises that Joseph's baptism were a symbol of. Maybe that's something you need to do some thinking about. Well, by the time the Israelites arrive in chapter 19, just flick over another couple of pages, they're safe and dry, and more than that, they've been made into a special nation with a unique relationship with God. So God kind of summarises what has happened in chapter 19, verse 4. You yourselves, he says, have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples. For all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel. God's people. Secondly, God's rule and blessing. And that's basically what the next bit of the Bible is all about. From Exodus 19 to the end of the next book, which is called Leviticus. And God had promised Abraham, and he'd said, I will bless you. And he promised to bless his family as well, and the nation that came from him. And he makes that happen in two main ways. With the Israelites, he gives them his law and he gives them his presence. And his law is kind of what happens in the next bit of the Bible that we've arrived at here. I don't want to say too much about this, but I do want to point out that God's laws are not an arbitrary list of rules, perhaps like the sort of rules you might have been made to obey at school. God's not some kind of divine killjoy. His laws are the loving commands of a saving God. So just flick over to the next chapter, chapter 20. It's one of the most famous passages in the whole Bible where God gives the Ten Commandments. What's often missed out, though, when people talk about the Ten Commandments is what God said before he gave them. Look at verse 2. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. In other words, God is saying obeying these laws
It's not about some kind of desperate attempt to get into my good books. It's not about earning rescue and relationship with God. They'd already got that before he gave them the laws. It's about responding to his rescue. A way to enjoy the blessings of life with God. I'm not going to say much more about it, but you can read it for yourself. And why not just have a look at them at some point this week and think about actually the inherent goodness of what God is commanding there. What would a world be like that was run along those kind of lines? What would a society be like that took these things seriously? Just have a read of them for yourself. If you want to know more about them, there's a picture up here that will help you. There you are. That's Moses' own website that you can have a look at to see more about the Ten Commandments. And God also blessed them by giving them not just his laws, but his presence as well. And again, this is a really key part of what God was all about in his plan for a kingdom. He wanted to live with his people, not distant like the politicians we have now, not far away in some house like a president or a king, but among his people like a father. And so what happens is that God gets Moses, just after this bit that we're reading now, God gets Moses to build a great big tent. And it has different levels of access to it. The innermost, most special level of access, the inner kind of tent, the tent within the tent, was a place where God would come and live among his people and make his presence known to them. And it was called the most holy place. And you can read about that in chapters 26 onwards. But the problem is, how can a God like this God live with a people like these people? How can a God who's perfect live with a bunch of people who constantly disobey him? How can a just, loving God live with people who are unjust and unloving? And that's the problem that gets addressed here. So what God gives them is a series of sacrifices to deal with the fact that they disobey him. So just flick on to the next book in the Bible, Leviticus. Now, what can I tell you about Leviticus? It's not a fun read. It's not bedtime reading, really. But it's basically all about these sacrifices that God gave them to deal with the fact that they constantly disobeyed him. It's all kind of working on the same principle as the Passover lamb that was killed in their place. That's what the sacrifices were all about. And they had to keep doing these sacrifices all the time. I mean, there's page after page after page of them. If you just flick through, page after page of offerings that they've got to offer up. I once heard about a student who had basically never read the Bible at all, but was curious. And so she picked up the Gideon's Bible that was in her halls of residence flat. And she started reading. And she started reading at Leviticus, just as you do. She didn't know any better. A few days later, she went to a Christian meeting that was held on campus. And she started talking with the people that she met there about what she'd been reading. And she said, well, I was reading about all these sacrifices in Leviticus that these guys had to keep doing. And you know what I think? What these guys need is a once-for-all perfect sacrifice that deals with their disobedience forever. And then they won't have to keep offering all of these sacrifices time and time again. And you know what? She was right. Because these sacrifices were just a signpost to how God would deal with people's disobedience through Jesus. He was the perfect sacrifice because he'd always obeyed God's laws, unlike people like us. He'd never deserved death, and yet he did die in people's place. No wonder then that for people who trust in his sacrifice, he offers and wins God's presence, not in some tent, in a symbolic way, but his real presence in the real holy place, God's house. Well, I must move on. Thirdly, God's place. And this is Numbers to Judges, the next few books of the Bible. You see, God had promised to Abraham, to your offspring, I will give this land. He promised land, a great land full of good stuff. And basically, the next three books of the Bible tell how God made good on that promise. Although the road to the promised land was not smooth.
So firstly, we get the whole book of Numbers. You don't need to turn to it because we're not going to look much at it at all. But basically what happens in Numbers is the Israelites get to the land that God has promised them and they get scared because the people living in the land are much bigger than them. And they forget and ignore the fact that God had promised that he would give them victory over those people. And they just choose to ignore God's promises. And instead they wander around in the desert for 40 years, for a whole generation. And so then when we get to the next book in the Bible, Deuteronomy, again, you don't need to turn to it. Moses is getting a bit old by this point. And it's kind of like Israel, the next generation, because the old generation died off in the wilderness. And they've come to the brink of the promised land again. They're about to go in. And basically Deuteronomy is one big long sermon saying, don't mess it up again. Keep trusting God's promises. Now when you're going into the land, and when you get in there as well, don't muck it up again. Well, Moses dies and it's left to his understudy, basically, a guy called Joshua. He leads the people into the land at last after 40 years of mucking around in the wilderness. So do turn to Joshua. In fact, turn to page 235. You see, by and large, the book Joshua is a success story. After all this faffing around for two or three books, they finally get to the promised land and things go really, really well. By and large. Just let's look at a verse that summarises the whole book. Joshua chapter 21 verse 43. And that's page 235. This summarises really what's been happening in the whole book. The Lord gave to Israel all the land that he swore to give to their fathers. And they took possession of it and they settled there. And the Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their fathers. Not one of all their enemies had withstood them, for the Lord had given all their enemies into their hands. Not one word of all the good promises that the Lord had made to the house of Israel had failed. All came to pass. And you kind of arrive at this point in the story, and if you've been following it along, you think, I can breathe a sigh of relief now, because we've got God's kingdom. We've got God's people in God's place, enjoying God's rule. If only it had proved to be as simple as that. Because the next book tells a different story. Flick over to Judges. Just two or three pages along. Flick over to page 242. And you see, the problem wasn't God's promises. It never is. The problem was people. The problem was with the Israelites. So just look at chapter 2, verse 11 to 14. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they abandoned the Lord. In other words, they follow after foreign gods. Verse 13, they abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtoreth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the hand of their surrounding enemies, so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them. But God didn't give up on them. Look at verse 16. The Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them. But even then, that didn't last long. Verse 17. Yet they did not listen to their judges, for they whored after other gods and bowed down to them. They soon turned away from the way in which their fathers had walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord, and they did not so. And basically the whole book is a cycle of that happening. They drift away, they get defeated by their enemies. God sends a judge. They get saved from their enemies. The next generation drifts away. And basically right at the end of the book we get a really depressing picture. Page 266. It's verse 25 of chapter 21. In those days, it says, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. The nation is in a complete mess. Everyone is just doing what they want to do. And did you notice, it says the problem is they've got no king. The right leadership
I wonder, our society is not that much different, is it? Everyone doing their own thing. I'll do it my way. What we need is a trustworthy leader. It's true, isn't it? Someone who has the authority, who can actually lead us in the right way to live. Someone who can protect us. A ruler who will govern in the right way. That's what we need, isn't it? And it was the same with Israel. And actually from now on we have a fourth part of God's kingdom. God's king. And that's the story of Ruth to 2 Samuel. But just before we go on to that, we're going to have a second reading. And Paul Robinson is going to come and read it for us. It's in 2 Samuel. But I'm sure he'll tell you the page number. Even better.
Right then. 2 Samuel chapter 7 from verse 4. But that same night the word of the Lord came to Nathan. Go and tell my servant David, thus says the Lord, would you build me a house to dwell in? I have not lived in a house since the day I brought up the people of Israel from Egypt to this day, but I've been moving about in a tent for my dwelling. In all places where I have moved with all the people of Israel, did I speak a word with any of the judges of Israel, whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? Now, therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, that you should prince over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you went, and have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I will make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth. And I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, so that they may dwell in their own place and be disturbed no more. And violent men shall afflict them no more as formerly, from the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all your enemies. Moreover, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the son of men. But my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. In accordance with all these words, and in accordance with all this vision, Nathan spoke to David.
Thank you very much, Paul. We're on the home straight now, I do promise. You've listened very, very well. God's king. This is the other thing that God's kingdom needs. And it's kind of related to the rule and blessing thing. How does God rule and bless his people? By giving them a great king to lead them in the right way. And Judges had proved that that's what they needed. And that's why the book that comes after Judges is called Ruth, and it's a very, very short book. It's basically a love story about how God works in the background to make sure that this king comes about. It's basically God working behind the scenes to bring about the birth of this guy, David. And he is God's chosen king. He's who we were just reading about. In fact, it describes him in 1 Samuel chapter 13. It says that he is a man after God's own heart. He is in tune with God's desires. And when he comes on the scene, he saves the Israelites from their enemies. And he trusts God. He seems like the king that they need. And the whole of 1 Samuel is a story of God choosing David and then protecting David, even though there was a pretender to the throne ruling in Israel at that time, who was after David's throat. And you see, what happens is in 2 Samuel, that pretender to the throne dies and David is crowned king of the whole land, all of God's people. And in lots of ways, his rule is a real high point for them as a nation. They secure the land, they keep their enemies at bay, they enjoy rest again. They enjoy all of the good things of living with God. David even plans to build a permanent home for God to replace the tent
a temple. The only trouble is, great as he is, David is flawed too. Just a couple of chapters after we were reading there, what happens with David is he commits adultery and then murders to try and make up for it. But you see, the real significant thing about David's part in the Bible story is in that chapter that we looked at. It's the promise that God makes to David. It's not about how great David is, it's about how good God's promise is. So just look at it again. In that chapter, 2 Samuel chapter 7. Look at verse 12. He promises him a son. He says, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you. So he says, you're going to have a son, David. And he also says, verse 14, that this son of David will be a son of God. Verse 14, I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. He will have that relationship with God, as a father has to a son. And this son will have an everlasting kingdom. Look at verse 16. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. What God is basically promising here is not a partial kingdom, but the real thing. An everlasting kingdom through someone that is going to come from David's family. He says, you're not the real thing, David, but someone from your family line will be the real thing. And you know, it seems like that's Solomon, his son. When David has a son, Solomon, he seems great at first, but then he messes up. And so it's not him. And things kind of go downhill for the partial kingdom after that. We'll be learning more about that next week. But God's promise still stands. And that's why when we get to the second half of the Bible, there is such a lot of excitement about this guy called Jesus. Just flick on with me to Romans chapter 1. This is the final bit that we'll be looking at. Romans chapter 1, which is page 1131. It's basically a letter written by a missionary, but what he says about Jesus is what I want to point out here. He says, Paul, a servant of Christ Jesus, called to be an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God, which he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures, concerning his son, who was descended from David according to the flesh. In other words, a son of David. And verse 4, and was declared to be the son of God. So a son of David, a son of God. The Son of God. Declared to be the Son of God in power through the Spirit of holiness by his resurrection from the dead, Jesus Christ, our Lord, through whom we have received grace and apostleship to bring about the obedience of faith for the sake of his name among all the nations. In other words, this Jesus wants people from the whole world in his kingdom. The Bible says, whereas David wasn't the real thing, Jesus was. Well, I'm going to conclude. There's going to appear a diagram here. That's basically the story so far. God's kingdom in creation, it was great. And then people messed it up. So God promised that there would be a return. And this is what we've seen today. Is that there was a kind of a partial return of God's kingdom. God's people, Israel, in God's place, the promised land, under God's rule and blessing, with God's law, his presence, and the special king that he'd given them. But it was only a partial. And it was basically a pointer to Jesus. Hey, now it strikes me, all of these things in God's kingdom are things that deep down we basically all need. And all want. So God's people, we all want family. We all want relationship. We all want relationship with each other. And I think if we were asked and we thought it could be possible, we would all want relationship with our Creator too, if we thought it was something that was really possible. God's people, God's place. We all need a home, don't we? A place to belong. Somewhere to call our own. Somewhere to work. Somewhere to enjoy. God's rule and blessing. We all need the right leadership, the right guidance in our lives. We all want to know how to make the best of life. We all want the happiness of life lived as it is actually meant to be lived by the Creator's design. I doubt the elections, whenever they are held this year, will give us the leader that we need or the life that we really want. I want to suggest that ultimately, if you trace all of those things to their source, that's only available in this kingdom that God has promised. And he fulfilled it in a partial way in Israel's history. And he did that to point out what it was going to be like when he came and did it big time. He's got it planned, and he's currently building that kingdom now by calling people to follow Jesus as their king and rescuer. Let me pray. Oh God, thank you that you haven't given up on people so many times when we have messed it up. And thank you that no matter what we have done, you invite us to belong to your kingdom. And we do pray that every one of us would take that seriously and do the thinking about it that we need to do. Amen.